accession number 19043, Reel 5.
Could we just finish off now? Oh, this is Reel 5, by the way. Colonel Pendleton, Reel 5. Can we finish off by talking about the period when you were in Jamaica, which I think was 56-58?
Yes.
Can you tell me what job you had then?
I was posted there from the staff college, which I was at in 1955, and then after 2 or 3 months at the technical staff college, I was posted to Jamaica as the DAQMG of Caribbean Area. And that was quite an interesting job. I don't think the sort of job that a career officer looked for. But I was very tempted by the idea of going there because I was by now married and had 2 small children, and I thought the Caribbean would be a good place for them.
This is Deputy Assistant Quartermaster General.
Yes. Our duties out there were to ensure the sort of peace in the area, which stretched from Belize down through the islands and down as far as Trinidad. There was one British battalion based in Jamaica, and there was the Jamaica Regiment, and there were 1 or 2 other local forces in the area. We didn't have many excitements. I think the only one that I remember well was an occasion when there was a threat to Belize from Guatemala, and some armed people were seen on the border. So there was a sort of general alarm at this, and Hugh Foote, who was the governor of Jamaica, called a conference to which I went, and they discussed what they should do. Apart from the military forces, which I've mentioned briefly, there was a wonderful sailor who had the title Snowy in the area, and there was one survey ship belonging to the Royal Navy. And it was decided that this survey ship should be used to take a party of troops to Belize. And I was amused at the time that was spent at this conference considering what would be the most dramatic moment for the grey shape to be seen on the horizon by the citizens of Belize, because I think I've got slightly confused. It was felt that there were people in Belize who were sympathetic to the Guatemalans, and that was really who we were going to sort of deal with. And so the grey shape appearing, it was very important that it should psychologically appear at the right moment. Should it be in the middle of the day when people were out of their offices and sort of on the seafront, or should it be at dawn? And it really was quite amusing. But in the end, we did send a company over there, and the thing calmed down. There was nothing really very dramatic going on. We had no serious trouble in Jamaica either, although the political situation was not very, very happy. And it wasn't really very nice to go down into certain parts of Kingston. But there was no military threat, really, at all.
In what way was it not nice to go into certain parts of Kingston?
Well, the locals, there was a racial problem developing. And there were certain areas where they were very much anti-white. And this was building up a bit in those days. But we had a very happy time there. We lived outside the barracks. We lived up on the hills above Kingston in a house belonging to a Jamaican who was the lands officer for Jamaica. And he and his wife were very nice to us and let us have their house, and they had another one somewhere else. And we got to know one or two Jamaicans quite well. And we still keep in touch with them. But the atmosphere was getting a bit unpleasant from a racial point of view. The political situation was always entertaining between the rival parties. Bustamante, the conservative man, was a very colourful character, and Manley was the other leader of the Labour Party. And there were always squabbles going on. I did, to divert for a moment, because I think it's almost linked with the Caribbean area, I did later on have to take over command of the 1st Battalion in British Guyana. This was in 1963, and that was quite an interesting journey to get there, because Guyana was experiencing one of the longest general strikes in history. And the only way I could get there to take over my command was to go to Dutch Guyana and get a small beach craft or something, privately hire it and fly in on that. There were no aircraft flying into the main airport at Guyana. And anyway, I took over, and it was quite a tricky situation, because the Asian population who were the head of which was
Chedi Jagan
and his wife Janet. He headed the Asian population, and Burnham headed the African, and they were at one another's throats. And one interesting situation was they were going to have a vote of confidence at one time, and Chedi Jagan had got a majority of 2 in the Legislative Assembly. But owing to some provocation, the police arrested these 2 men the evening before there was going to be a vote of confidence. So, and I suppose the Speaker could have had the casting vote if everyone had been there. But Chedi Jagan took fright. And to our utter astonishment, half an hour before the Legislative Assembly was due to meet, I think it was at sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but at 2:30, the word got round, the buzz got round, that the mace had disappeared. So there was so great to do, trying to find the mace. And it was eventually, needless to say, found under Chedi Jagan's house. But that was a sort of, if you like, looking back on it, slightly musical comedy situation that one got involved with there. There was some nasty rioting before we left between the Asians and the Africans. And in trying to keep the peace, we did sometimes find ourselves in slightly awkward situations. And we did have a situation one night when a platoon of ours was attacked by some Asian people with sticks and things. And it was rather an ugly affair. And the platoon commander, using the green book, went through the drills of reading the riot act and so on and so forth, and got to the point where he fired a shot at who he thought was was a ringleader, and he killed him. Well, it was interesting for me as a responsible or senior military figure there to know how to handle it. And what we in fact did, it stopped, all the rioting stopped immediately. And there was no sort of angry comeback at that time. And it wasn't covered by the press particularly. So we decided we would, if you like, play it cool. We had the governor was on our side and felt that it had been justified and so on. We sent the officer concerned out of the country straight away. And it calmed down. And for the rest of our time there, there was never any trouble. It was interesting, looking back, that we were able to do that. I don't think now, 10 years later, if there was any situation like that, we would have, if you like, got away without an enormous press hype on the situation, because it was an unfortunate thing to have had to do. But I don't think anyone in the Asian community there really at the end of the day was saying we'd done a most heinous act. Probably his family, probably the man's family did. But I can't see it being treated in quite the same way today, particularly if it was in a place where there was a more active or influential press. I mean, we didn't have international press people sort of there all the time. We did get visits occasionally, and when there would be press come, we had the colonial secretary come to visit the place while this was going on, and I think he was accompanied by one or two press people, you see. But when he wasn't there, the local press didn't hype it up. And the thing just died down. And I don't suppose anybody's ever heard about the massacre in New Amsterdam. It would have been called that by today's press, I think, by some of them. Anyway, the thing was...
It was in a place called New Amsterdam?
I think it was near New Amsterdam. I could look it up on a map, but I haven't got it. It was not in Georgetown. It was down the coast a bit from Georgetown. I think it was New Amsterdam. But I look back on that and I think, well, that's the way it should have been treated, because it was an unfortunate thing to have to do, but... it certainly had the required effect in those circumstances. And as I say, we never had any more bother. They still squabbled amongst themselves a bit, but if the army appeared on the streets, there was no trouble at all. And we were, after all, only trying to keep them from fighting amongst themselves. But it's not much is known about that incident, I don't think. So I thought I'd mention it in connection with the Caribbean area, although it's not part of the Caribbean area. It was quite funny because when this was all happening, the War Office decided to send some reinforcements out because they thought it was getting out of hand. I don't think it was myself. But anyway, the brigadier was dispatched and another battalion... Battalion of Grenadiers was flown out, and while they were coming in, flying in Britannia aircraft, and I was discussing the situation with Snowy, who was Admiral, Edward Ashmore, and he was actually. Put in charge of this larger force. And And he got a message from the Ministry of Defence one day saying, we need to know how many troops are now on the island. And he thought this was hysterically funny that they didn't even know in London that British Guiana was a part of the mainland. And I'm not sure if he actually sent it. He said, I'm going to send back which island? But that's the more humorous side of these sort of incidents. I would like to sort of close this by just briefly saying that I ended my career in the Coldstream by commanding the 1st Battalion. Partly in Belize and then at home. I was able to command the trooping in 1964 and subsequently had the honour of being appointed the regimental lieutenant colonel. I retired in 1967 and had served then for 25 years as a Coldstreamer. I kept the connection going after that by being appointed a member of the Queen's bodyguard of the Yeoman of the Guard. And I continued with that for another 26 years, retiring as the lieutenant of the bodyguard in 1993, on my 70th birthday.